bring him back to me. Shir Hamalot Beshuv Adonai Et Shivat Zion Hayinu Kacholmim Az Yamale Schok Pinu Ul Shunenu Rina. His voice is off-key, plaintive, beseeching, and when our eyes meet across the dining table, he smiles at me and reaches over to pat my hand. A song of ascents. When the Lord will return the exiles of Zion, we will have been like dreamers. Then our mouths will be filled with laughter and our tongues with songs of joy. Emily and I continued our slow, long cross-country volley, increasingly sharing details of our lives. Our sons were both looking at colleges. Each of them was musical and particularly good at math. Our kids had taken part in marches and protests in reaction against the recent presidential election. We were both consumed with and disturbed by the news. I found Emily to be enormously empathic as I shared more of my story with her, and any caution she may have felt began to fall away. We started to make a plan to get together in late spring when I would be stopping in Portland on my book tour. Hope and curiosity was how she described her feelings toward me. Those words described how I felt as well. One afternoon, I opened an email from her that included a passage from the work of Pema Chodron, a Buddhist teacher and writer whom I had long admired. To be fully alive, fully human, and completely awake is to be continually thrown out of the nest. To live fully is to be always in no man's land. I had felt every day since the previous June that I now lived, exiled, forever wandering, in no man's land. But the truth was that this had always been the case. Any thought of solid ground was nothing more than an illusion, not only for me, but for all of us. Those words, completely awake, live fully, sent to me by the half-sister I had never known. I had strived for those states of being all my life, while a part of me slumbered. We will have been like dreamers. Now there would be no more slumber. You will be set free. Chapter 44. As I continued to correspond with both Ben and Emily, I tried to loosen my own reins on the very notion of certainty. It was no longer a desirable state, especially since I had spent my whole life being so certain and so wrong. Instead, I tried to ride each new wave like a surfer, fluid, balanced, focused, come what may. Over the holidays, I made batches of Christmas cookies. Why Christmas cookies? It was very nearly a joke, but it was also a kind of permission. Merry Christmas, David Ingber had said. I liked Christmas cookies. Why couldn't I bake them? I sprinkled gingerbread men and wreaths with red and green, allowed them to harden, and placed them in a jar on our kitchen counter. We lit Hanukkah candles each night, and Jacob and I chanted the brachot. Genetically speaking, I was half Ashkenazi Jewish, half Anglo-Saxon Presbyterian. My ancestors scattered far and wide. There could be confusion in that, or liberation. The choice was mine. I had been reading up on the rare hereditary eye disease Ben had told me about, the one medical condition he felt it was important for me to know. When I paid a visit to the ophthalmologist, indeed, a test revealed that I exhibited early signs of the disease. It was a condition that might affect me in later years, causing light to become diffuse, occluding my night vision. The worst-case scenario would be a corneal transplant way down the road. I learned that the recessive form is present prenatally and certainly by the time of birth. I was not my father's child. The eyes through which I saw the world from the moment they opened were eyes that I inherited from Ben Walden. To Danny Shapiro, from Ben Walden, subject, thanks. Hi, Danny. Thanks so much for the poem by W.S. Merwin. I'll plan to put it on my blog. It poignantly touches on the gift of aging and remembering. The other day, I was visiting two residents in a nursing home and talked to a frail fellow who had recently fallen out of bed. By taking time, sitting, and listening, He told me about his days as a trombone player with all the big-name bands. It was fun to see him light up as the memories poured forth. Pilar sends her warm regards to you, Michael, and Jacob. Love, Ben. This is what we had begun to do, Ben and I. We exchanged quotes. When I came across something that I thought he might like, I made a mental note to pass it along to him. An essay on an Australian website about faith, a reference to Walt Whitman's hospital visits on brain pickings, a haunting poem forwarded to me by a friend. I wrote him about a favorite novel, Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, and he wrote back that it was one of his favorites as well, so much so that he had recently read it for a second time. Was it a coincidence that we both loved the Stegner? Our literary sensibilities were remarkably similar. This overlap in our consciousness felt like a comfort and a loss all at once. Michael described what we were doing as a grown-up version of exchanging mixtapes, a way of a biological father and daughter who had never known each other saying, "This is who I am." Thought us. At the same time as Ben and I deepened our connection, the meadows surrounding my house blanketed in a hard layer of snow, the lakes frozen, dotted with the dark shapes of ice fishermen, my dad began to reappear. He emerged in my internal world as if he had been patiently waiting for me to be ready for him. At times, I would look up from a book I was reading and see him sitting there in his favorite cabled vest, a yarmulke covering his head. In Hebrew, the word for soul is neshama. It is variously translated as wind or breath. Try to capture it, and it disappears. I was once again able to feel my father's presence, those unmistakable chills running the length of my body. He seemed intent on letting me know that he was there. He looked at me with the distant benevolence of the ghost he was. He gave a single, slow nod, as if to acknowledge his sorrow that he wasn't able to come back to help me, that I had to navigate this hazardous terrain alone. I dug up some notes I had taken years earlier during a phone session with a medium. I had never quite believed in mediums or psychics, nor did I remember any urgency at the time about contacting the dead. My literary agent had urged me to make the appointment, and I tended to do whatever she suggested. Now, I scanned the torn-out notebook pages as if they were a relic from another era. The medium and I had spoken of my parents, but this all fell into the category of before I knew the truth about them, about me. I almost just shoved the notes back into the file cabinet, but then I got to the part about my father. He apologizes for not speaking the truth in your childhood. A lot left unsaid. He says someday you will understand why he needed to walk this path alone. The words hadn't resonated with me back then. I had been skeptical of the whole enterprise, but now they stood out. Certainly, there had been a lot left unsaid. The truth hadn't been spoken. He had been solitary and had set himself apart. And now, my father's apology, there in my own handwriting, as dictated by the medium, assumed an entirely new potential meaning. He was trying to tell me something. It was almost as if he knew what was in store for me. I watched a documentary by a Canadian filmmaker named Barry Stevens, who learned as a young man that he had been donor-conceived and began searching for his biological father in midlife. Stevens interspersed research into his paternity with film footage from his childhood in which he and his parents, his mother and his social father, as it turned out, were on vacation in California. The footage shows a man trailing several feet behind his family as they walk outside a winery. His head is slightly bowed, his hands clasped behind his back. He appears nearly servile, as if he feels undeserving to be walking alongside them. It made me think of my father and his own diminishment, my mother's disgust, her patronizing tone when she spoke with him or about him, her pure and unmistakable contempt. This, too, I had always believed I understood, and found narratives, reasons to support my understanding. But now, my father's retreat from the world seems to be, at least in part, the price he paid for becoming my father. I spent my entire adult life trying to make him proud. Not a day had passed since his death during which I didn't think of him or silently confer with him. My initial piercing sorrow at our lack of biological connection had begun to fade, as had the double sorrow as I came to believe he'd carried the truth in his heart. Through the medium, he'd apologized to me for leaving so much unsaid. But how could he have said it? How? When the complex web of doctors and specialists insisted that silence was best for the entire family. I heard Shirley's voice once again. Knowing what you know, you're more of a daughter to Paul than you can possibly imagine. I may have been cut from the same cloth as Ben Walden, but I was and forever would be Paul Shapiro's daughter. Haskell Lookstein's voice joined Shirley's in my head. Kol hakavod to your father. All the honor. If not for him, I would never have been born. I was connected to him on the level of neshama, which had nothing to do with biology and everything to do with love. Chapter 45. At a conference in Miami that winter, I attended a talk by Luke Dietrich, a journalist who had written a book about his grandfather, the surgeon famous for performing a lobotomy on a severely epileptic man, which had the unintended consequence of complete and irreversible memory loss. The man became known as Patient H.M. and was, for the next 60 years, the most studied patient in the history of neuroscience. Dietrich's grandfather had been a prolific lobotomist, performing thousands of these psychosurgeries during the 1940s and 50s, a time during which the procedures were considered the last best resort for certain brain injuries and mental disorders. Today, of course, the idea of driving a sharp instrument through the eye with a mallet in order to sever the brain's prefrontal lobe is barbaric and insane. But at the time, in the United States alone, 40,000 people were lobotomized. The surgeons performing lobotomies believed they were doing good, important, humane work. One of the surgeons who developed the lobotomy even won the Nobel Prize, though recently there has been a movement to rescind the prize, calling the innovation a massive error in judgment. I attended Dietrich's lecture in part because I had long been interested in the history of neuroscience, but also because the subtitle of his book, Patient H.M., A Story of Memory, Madness, and Family Secrets, caught my eye. His family's secrets were very different from my own, but what he and I shared was the long lens through which we were forced to see the context of the times. In the 1940s, lobotomies were normalized. People, patients, their families, were told the procedure would help. They may even have been told it was a treatment. Doctors were not to be argued with, as was true when it came to the very different matter of donor conception in the early 1960s. The eugenic benefits of donor conception were discussed confidently and with no sense of self-consciousness. The children conceived in this manner were considered to have great advantages in life. They were the genetic progeny of men of science, men of fine character, men with exemplary family histories. The children would never know the truth of their origins, and the social fathers could comfortably believe whatever they chose. But the truth was darker and more complicated than even this. Doctors inseminated patients with their own sperm or the sperm of whoever happened to be available. There were very few clinics or hospitals that put restrictions on the number of times a man might donate, resulting in scores of half-siblings in small geographical areas. I had just heard a story from a writer friend. He had been a sperm donor a couple of decades back when he was homeless and living out of his car, having been a drug addict and ward of the state. I made up a whole profile, he told me. Harvard educated, varsity tennis player. I was very popular. Modern notions of informed consent did not exist, Dietrich said from the auditorium stage. What did my parents sign? Were records ever kept, or were they immediately destroyed? I had tried to reach Edmund and Augusta Farris's three children, who were now in their 70s, a number of times, but they hadn't responded to my entreaties. Their son, also named Edmund, was a singer on Carnival Cruise Lines. I knew he had received my email because he mistakenly forwarded it back to me with a note to his sister. Sue, what do you think? Shame, shame, and more shame. The present overlaid on the past, casting an angry, judgmental pall. It was impossible not to question how anyone had ever thought the practices of the day were sound and safe. I wondered what the Farris offspring now thought about what their parents had done, the two of them practicing medicine without a license in their renegade institute. What did they know? Were they proud? Disturbed? Was it devastating to them that their father had been forgotten? Or perhaps there had been mishaps, mistakes, stories that hadn't turned out quite as well as mine. I don't want to be a presentist, the author was saying. Presentism, the anachronistic introduction of present-day ideas and perspectives into depictions or interpretations of the past. It would be easy to fall into such thinking. I had done so from the moment I discovered the truth of my identity. Those early months were taken up first with the disbelief that my parents could have ever knowingly participated in such a deceit, and then later with anger and sorrow that they had made the choices they did, even though those choices resulted in my existence. For a long time, I was able to put myself in their shoes only as myself, product of the late 20th and early 21st centuries, with all the biological, genetic, historical, and psychological tools available to me. But now, I was coming to the awareness that my young parents-to-be had none of these tools. They possessed only their own fear, shame, despair, and desire for a child at any cost. They joined hands and went deeper into the wilderness until the only way out was through. There was no going back. And then they pretended that it had never happened. They never spoke of it again, not to each other, not to family, nor to friends. My mother, now successfully pregnant, went back to her obstetrician in his office lined with celebrity headshots. As I became heavier in her belly, so too did her certainty grow that I was my father's child. How could it be otherwise? My mother had always had a remarkable ability to bend reality to her will. The obstetrician most likely had known nothing, or chose to know nothing, about my parents' visits to the Farris Institute. From the pages of Feingold's 1964 book, Artificial Insemination, in AI, the child is never told. It was perhaps the most painful reading I had done, its language clinical and self-satisfied. Feingold was thorough and covered matters such as AI and the public, AI and religion, AI and the law. Throughout, there was a stress on anonymity. The doctor described the way legal questions of paternity might be dispensed with by referring a freshly inseminated woman to an outside obstetrician unaware of the artificial impregnation. To prevent the courts from establishing that a donor was the father of the child, some gynecologists mix the husband's semen with that of the donor. Some rely on the strict secrecy involved with AI to deter litigation. Many doctors refer their pregnant AI patients to an obstetrician who is not aware of the donor insemination. If the obstetrician knows that the husband is not the father of the newborn child, it is dishonest and illegal for him to claim the husband as the father on the birth certificate. A well-known and respected author on infertility insists that the white lie is a kindly, humane act. He wrote, "It is a violation, like burning fallen leaves in the street, so they will not scatter over the neighbor's lawn. It is the type of offense to which the good accomplished completely neutralizes the infraction of a law." On the day of my birth, my father's name was entered on my birth certificate. Dearest darling. Now there would be no question he was my father. It's been long. It's been hard. His name was on the ultimate document of identity. A white lie. A kindly, humane act. No different from burning fallen leaves in the street. Chapter 46. A principle often used in theoretical physics is Occam's razor, attributed to the 14th century logician whose name it bears. The principle holds that entities should not be multiplied unnecessarily. It was later refined by Sir Isaac Newton, who wrote in Principia Mathematica, "We are to admit no more causes of natural things than such as are both true and sufficient to explain their appearances." Michael had raised the principle of Occam's razor to me early in my struggle to understand what my parents had known. He told me that a popular follow-up statement in the scientific realm is, when you have two competing theories that make the exact same predictions, the simpler one is the better. I rebelled against the notion at first, reflexively, self-protectively. Nothing about my discovery was simple, and for a long while, it felt safer to weave Byzantine stories about deception, cover-ups, and intrigue, since these felt closer to the shock of my experience. But scientific method eventually became a key component in my arrival at a resting place, a narrative of sorts, distrusting of narratives as I had become, for the likeliest story. The simplest explanation for my parents' pilgrimage to the Farris Institute was that Edmund Farris was known for his use of sperm donors. Full stop. Treatments, boosts, the thicket of euphemism aside, this is what Farris did. And so, wherever on that slide rule of consciousness versus denial that my parents found themselves, there was knowledge, deep knowledge, buried knowledge. In the case of my mother, I believe, acute dissociation when it came to the truth of who I was and where I came from. As much as the most painful parts of my discovery had to do with my father, giving me insight into his depression, his physical and psychic pain, his decline, my mother was, of course, at the center of it. Though I had spent far more time thinking about what this meant for my dad, my mother had been the engine. She was active. He was melancholy, passive. She was someone who would never have taken no for an answer. His life had been lived as if no had been shouted at him since the day he was born. It was my mother who would have done the research and found Edmund Farris, rogue scientist, man with a plan. It was my mother who would have made the appointment, and if there was convincing to do, if the conversation ever became detailed and honest, conscious, it would have been my mother who would have done the convincing. But then I was born, and whatever sequelae there might have been to the unorthodox methods surrounding my conception vanished into the ether of magical thinking. If it wasn't thought, it wasn't so. If it wasn't spoken, it hadn't happened. Except that secrets, particularly the most deeply held ones, have a way of leaching into everything surrounding them. A psychoanalytic phrase, the unthought known, became my instrument of illumination as I poked and prodded at my history with my parents. The psychoanalyst who coined it, Christopher Bolas, writes, "There is in each of us a fundamental split between what we think we know and what we know but may never be able to think." "I gave you life," my mother screamed at me whenever she was at her angriest, when I wasn't complying with her wishes or to her will. "I gave you life." I had always found it borderline funny, but also disturbing, that my mother felt the need to underscore this bedrock parental fact. On each of my birthdays as an adult, I was meant to call her. It never occurred to me that it was usually the other way around, and thank her for having me. But here were the noxious fumes, leaking from beneath the sealed door where the truth resided. She named me Danielle, not Danielle, not a plain name like Lisa or Wendy, or, come to think of it, Susie, something simple and easy to pronounce. Not a biblical name like Sarah or Rebecca, not a family name, of which there had been some perfectly fine ones, Anna, Beatrice. In Moses, A Human Life, the biblical scholar Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg writes that, classically, naming a child is an opportunity for self-reflection. What had my mother made of this opportunity to name her child, who was already being born into such unusual circumstances? She was proud of her originality, her ingenuity, in choosing a name for me that had never been chosen before. In recent months, I typed my own name into names.org to see if perhaps there might be a hint as to its origins. Out of 5,743,017 in the United States Social Security public data, the name Daniil was not present. You simply have a name that no one else in America is using. For 136 years, only your parents have thought of using your name. Hoorah! You are a unique individual. Another trenchant line from the psychoanalyst Bolas. We learn the grammar of our being before we grasp the rules of our language. He's speaking of infancy, of course, and the underpinnings of our psyches. The grammar of my being, the mortar into which words would eventually settle, was formed by a mother who had shoved the truth of me away from her so forcefully that all that was left was a chasm, the tender ground just after a quake. Her trembling eyes, her practiced smile, trained on me, insisting from minute one that I was different, special, other, and above all, hers. Daniil, spelled D-A-N-E-I-L-E. It was a name that called attention to itself, that required an explanation. It stopped people. I had to spell it out for official documents or when making travel reservations. And still, more often than not, airplane tickets would arrive for Danielle, Danelle, Danielle, Daniel. I'd be stopped in security lines when the discrepancy was noticed. All my life, in addition to being asked how it was possible that I was Jewish, I was asked if Danny was my real name. Yes, I would say. It took too much out of me to explain. Sometimes I would add that I had never thought of myself as Daniil, not once, not even as a child. I never answered to it. But was this true? Try as I might, I couldn't ask the child I once was what she understood about herself and the grammar of her being before the rules of her language set in. Chapter 47. One afternoon, while sitting in my office, I glanced up at the portrait of my grandmother that hung over the chaise where Michael and I had felt the first stunning blow about my paternity. "Who are you to me?" I asked the woman in the portrait. She didn't seem ready to answer. And so I reached up and removed the heavy frame from its hook. I replaced it with a piece by the artist Debbie Millman, a large, blown-up yellow legal pad on which, in the top corner, in her own script, are the words, "This, just this, I am comfortable not knowing." I put my grandmother off to the side, to be reckoned with at a later date. I thought of John Keats' negative capability. When man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. In this direction lay freedom, and paradoxically, self-knowledge. By my being willing not to know thoroughly who I am and where I come from, the rigid structures surrounding my identity might begin to give way, leaving behind a sense of openness and possibility. I was beginning to see the danger in adhering to a single narrative, hewing to a story. The peril wasn't only in getting it wrong. It was in a kind of calcification, a narrowing, a perversion of reality that hardened and stilled the spirit. Back when Rabbi Lookstein had asked me which story would ease my heart, it felt impossible to me that I could survive without knowing what had been real. But I was at the threshold of understanding what Shirley had meant about my not being an accident of history. Or rather, either all of us are accidents of history, or none of us are. One sperm, one egg, one moment. An interruption, a ringing phone, a knock on the door, a flashlight through the car window. A single second, one way or the other, and the result would be an entirely different human being. Mine was just more complicated, an accident involving vials, syringes, contracts, and secrets. A couple of hours after Jacob was born, my mother entered my hospital room at Mount Sinai in New York City, the very same place where she had given birth to me 37 years earlier, and where my birth certificate had been signed. She leaned over Jacob, who was bundled in a blanket, cradled in my arms, and examined him, her face composed, mask-like. "He looks just like a Shapiro," she finally said. "He has the Shapiro forehead and the Shapiro chin." Was my mother perversely manipulating the moment, like the magician who appears to bend a spoon without touching it? Could she have been thinking about her own experience giving birth at this very same hospital to an infant whose father was a complete unknown? I don't think so. I think that when my mother first laid eyes on her only grandson, she believed that he was my father's grandson as well. And when Jacob was terribly sick as a baby, stricken by a rare seizure disorder, about which little was understood or known, its origins possibly hereditary, I'm convinced that my mother did not lie awake at night, wondering if the time had come to tell me the truth of my paternity. After all, if the disease that threatened Jacob was hereditary, what was there to be done? There were no records. Easy commercial DNA testing did not yet exist. There was no trail of breadcrumbs to follow. I confidently told the doctors that there was no family history of seizures. Choices were made, theories posited, based on more false information. It would have been a dreadful, perhaps unforgivable thing for my mother to have withheld information from me at the time of Jacob's illness. Even if the information may have led to further frustration or a dead end, it would have been my right, as a mother of a mortally sick infant, to know it. But, though I'll never be certain, I don't believe that's what happened. The narrative my mother clung to as if it were the only buoy in the sea was the way she had managed to get through her life. It had contributed to her becoming a miserable, alien creature, a woman who radiated rage. When the careful seams of her well-honed narrative momentarily came undone, my daughter was conceived in Philadelphia, she quickly stitched them up again. During the year of Jacob's illness, as Michael and I medicated him around the clock and watched him every waking moment for signs of a flicker of motion that would indicate a seizure, my mother seemed to grow more and more furious with us. As we attempted to save our child's life, she criticized us for not properly tending to his needs. One winter night, she screamed at me for not having covered his head as we carried him from the front door of her apartment building into a heated waiting car. It was the seam beginning to unravel. The box of her papers that we found in the basement, the one in which I discovered the florist's card from my father, yielded its secrets slowly. Just as in my research on the history of donor insemination, I could take only so much before I had to pack it away. It took months to examine it all. Wax envelopes filled with my baby hair, labeled Danny's Spun Gold. Other small envelopes containing baby teeth. There were reams of my artwork, finger paintings of a little girl who depicted her mother as a jagged-toothed monster and herself as a small, shapeless blob. If a father appeared at all, he was a faint stick figure, off to one side. My mother had saved a letter I had written to her when I was in the third grade, and had apparently received a poor grade on a math quiz. In it, I promised her that nothing like this would ever happen again, and I begged her to forgive me. But it was the way it was signed that I found most unsettling. "Yours in sorrow, Danielle." The truth in a thousand shards all around me. I had been certain that I had never thought of myself as Danielle, nor answered to the name. But here it was, written in my own loopy little girl script. I had always known that I hadn't felt at ease around my mother, but I hadn't known that I had been so frightened of her. "Yours in sorrow." Stories ran like water through my open fingers. There was a letter written by my mother to the director of a sleepaway camp I attended when I was 12. "Danielle may not have wet hair. I am sending her with a heated comb and she must dry her hair after swimming. I would like to prevent colds as much as possible. She thinks she's a good diver, but the back arches too much. She must be watched carefully. She is allergic to insect bites, and the area rapidly swells and enlarges. Usually, bites are first swabbed with ammonia. She may be given Benadryl, as per her pediatrician's instructions. The letter went on for 2 single-spaced typed pages filled with bullet points, with passages underlined for emphasis. Of all the box's contents, I found it most unbearable to read. My mother was presenting me as an object, valuable, delicate, not made of the stuff of the other campers. It pained me to imagine what the camp director must have thought about the fragile, high-maintenance child being entrusted to his care. As I neared the last of the letters and documents in the box, I came upon a letter my mother had written to me only a few months before she died of lung cancer. She was concerned about 3-year-old Jacob rubbing his head and worried that he might later develop migraines, which are hereditary. "Just in case, as your father had migraines somewhat, and as I mentioned to you, I noticed that Jacob sometimes rubs his head after he gets up from watching his little television." I read the sentence over and over again. It seemed more astonishing than my memory of my mother upon first seeing Jacob at Mount Sinai. There was something even more than a physical similarity she was imagining. This was a genetic condition, something inherited. There was no mistaking the transparent overlay, the world she created on top of the world that was. My mother's letter to me seemed to come to a close with an unusually sentimental line, all in caps. "Thank you for making me a mommy and grandmom." She was dying. She was nearing 80, and I was nearing 40. All my life, she had asked for my thanks. And now, in her own way, she was attempting to thank me. But before the letter ended, my mother added one more passage. It was another unraveling stitch in the seam. She referenced a large manila envelope filled with cards and letters sent to my parents congratulating them on my birth, and a particular, elaborate pink card that opened like an accordion. On the first page was a couple, a husband and wife, along with a stork and a brand new baby. The final page of the card was crowded with a note in a stranger's careful cursive, congratulating my mother on the birth of a beautiful young lady, and a request to please send a photo for all the girls in the office. My mother must not have been able to help herself. The final words, in what may have been the last letter she ever wrote to me, her parting shot, were all in lowercase and in parentheses, almost as if they didn't exist at all. "By the way, this handwritten note from Mrs. Farris, I had totally forgotten about it. Her husband, Dr. Farris, was he, without whom there probably wouldn't have been the." Chapter 48. Three of us, Michael, our attorney, and I, sat on a bench outside a probate judge's chambers in a nondescript suburban Connecticut courthouse. The long carpeted corridor was silent and empty, lined in paneled wood. As the big clock on the wall ticked a few minutes past the appointed hour, a woman came out to let us know that the judge was running behind schedule. My attorney placed his folder on his lap, and we waited for our meeting beneath the fluorescent lights. We had brought all the paperwork, and I hoped it would be in order. Birth certificate, social security card, driver's license, and an official petition to the court. Reflexively, I reached up and touched my left shoulder. It was still a bit sore. 2 weeks earlier and 3,000 miles away, I lay on a metal table in Los Angeles, in the sun-drenched studio of the tattoo artist known as Dr. Wu. My fists had been clenched, girding myself for the pain. A friend had offered to come with me. Another had suggested that I ask Wu to use lidocaine or numbing cream. Yet another had advised pre-medicating with a glass of wine. But I didn't want to be accompanied on this day, nor did I wish to be numbed. The pain, if there was to be pain, was a part of this, I wanted to feel everything. I was marking my body, permanently memorializing the before and after of my discovery. Dr. Wu, whose delicate designs I found on Instagram as I scrolled through thousands of artists, often incorporated compasses into many of his tattoos. The compasses were made of lines and circles, so light and thin they appeared like unspooled thread, arrows so delicate it seemed they might spin. It was my first tattoo. That there is a prohibition against Jews getting tattoos was something I was acutely aware of, and yet that was a part of it as well. It was subversive, rebellious. I'm half Jewish, half something else. Why not allow that, announce that, be that? I'm a hybrid, made of two sets of ancestors who would never have crossed paths or sprung from the same village. I had decided on my shoulder, not a hidden place, a secret spot that only those most intimate with me would see. My shoulder was visible, if I wished it to be. The following afternoon, I had an appointment with Rabbi David Wolpe, the senior rabbi of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. I had long admired Wolpe for his brilliant and incisive thinking. I had already planned to wear a cardigan to keep my transgression private. I was afraid he would judge me, though I needn't have been concerned. I would quickly come to realize that David Wolpe had no time to waste on antiquated propriety. "We all feel as if we're other," he told me. "Any thinking person knows we are other. Only you've actually been to the front lines of otherness, and you've come back with something to teach us." As we sat in his quiet inner sanctum, he recited the words of Elizabeth Barrett Browning. "God answers sharp and sudden on some prayers, and thrusts the thing we have prayed for in our face, a gauntlet with a gift in it." In that instant, my fresh tattoo hidden beneath my summer cardigan, I understood what the rabbi was offering. My newfound awareness was both gauntlet and gift. The choice wasn't to see it as one or the other. It was to embrace it as both. In Dr. Wu's studio, a far cry from the hallowed halls of Sinai Temple, I explained my reason for wanting a tattoo to the artist. "Last spring I found out that my father was not my biological father," I told him, keeping the story as brief as possible. I wondered how many stories he heard every day, reasons people have for turning their bodies into canvases, vessels, statements of identity. The young donor-conceived people Wendy Kramer had told me about had desperately, fruitlessly searched for their biological fathers until they settled for a series of numbers, the donor ID, inked into their arms as if to say, "This is all I know of who I am." "I'd like a bird," I told Wu. "What kind of bird?" he asked. His Instagram feed was full of birds, eagles, ravens, hawks. "I don't want an angry bird," I said. Wu began to sketch on a piece of paper. "Not a fierce bird," I went on, "and not a hummingbird." Michael had pointed out to me that hummingbirds hover. I wanted one that soared. "Maybe a swallow," he said. "Maybe a sweet bird." My eyes stung. "A free bird." On the table, as Dr. Wu began needling the bird into the front of my shoulder, I hardly felt a thing. It was as if I were floating, suspended somewhere in the in-between. My clenched fists loosened. The meditation teacher, Jack Kornfield, often begins his meditations by saying, "Take your seat beneath the tree of enlightenment, halfway between heaven and earth." I felt as if I were taking my seat, taking my place, as a human being who had undergone a profound experience and was now integrating it, creating a sign on my own body. "Ukashar tam li'ot al yadecha v'hayu l'totafot bein enecha." I heard the words of the central prayer, V'ahavta, as if they were being chanted beside me. "Take to heart these instructions with which I charge you on this day. Impress them upon your children. Bind them as a sign on your hand, and let them serve as a symbol on your forehead." I had been raised with the powerful idea that we must show the world who and what we are. We must keep mezuzot on our doorposts, and men must wear yarmulkes on their heads. I closed my eyes as Dr. Wu continued to make me my own sign, incorporating tiny compasses and two faint circles, hints of direction, around the swallow's beak. Migratory birds have internalized compasses. They use Earth's geomagnetic field, along with light, stars, and other cues, to guide them as they fly. I hadn't known north from south, east from west. I had been clueless about my own coordinates. Beneath all the comments I had fielded thrummed the most fundamental questions. Who are you? What are you? They were beneath Mrs. Kushner's baffling statement, beneath Mark Strand's icy renunciation of who I thought myself to be. It was the subtext of every pronouncement about my ethnicity. For the rest of my life, I wanted a visual reminder that now I had my own internalized compass. I knew what and who I was. Now, the map was mine. The judge at the probate court of the state of Connecticut was finally ready to see us. We all sat around a conference table, and my attorney distributed his prepared documents. The judge, wearing a suit, asked me to raise my hand and recite an oath. Then he asked why I had petitioned the court to change my given name. "Because I hate it," I said. "Because no one can pronounce it or spell it. Because I've never answered to it." Which wasn't entirely true, of course. I had painful proof that I once had answered to it. I signed the papers in front of the judge, county clerk, my attorney, and Michael. The document was then stamped with an official seal, an undoing. The little girl with the unpronounceable name, who stared and stared at her face in the mirror, trying to understand what she was seeing, was finally a grown woman who knew who she was and where she came from. Daniil was a name that had been handed me along with so many other mysteries of my existence, but I didn't have to be stuck with it. This was something I could let go. "Your name is now legally Danny Shapiro," said the judge. "Just like that?" I asked. Somehow I thought it would take longer to unravel something that had identified me for a lifetime. I hadn't understood that at that very moment my given name would fall away, fly off, like the swallow on my shoulder. 2 weeks earlier, I had reclaimed my body. Now I was reclaiming my name. Later, I will change all my documents of identification, save one. My birth certificate will remain the same. Daniil, daughter of Paul. In Hebrew, that would be Daniela bat Pinchas. That piece of history, more true than not, can never be altered. Chapter 49. The month of May had seemed so far in the future when we'd had lunch with Ben and Pilar in New Jersey back in October. But now it had arrived, and along with it, my book tour. It had been nearly a year since I'd received my DNA results. Nearly a year of living in a new reality and adjusting to it the way the body acclimates to a new temperature. There was something to the old adage that time heals all wounds. I'm not so sure about the healing, but time certainly had brought me to a place of greater acceptance that this was indeed my life. I had changed my name and gotten a tattoo, outward signs of inward shifts. The phrase donor conceived no longer traumatized me. I could look at childhood photographs of myself with my parents with curiosity, as well as some measure of sorrow that I imagined would always be there. But the tremulous, mute, childlike denial of what I was seeing was gone. Once in a while, though, while driving down a country road, or as I crossed a busy intersection in the city on my way to an appointment, or even while sitting quietly in meditation, I would be overcome by the now familiar physical sensation of slipping into a void. I had come to understand this as the space between my father and Ben. Neither of my two fathers could ever be entirely mine. Everyone is begotten and points backwards, deeper down, into the depths of beginnings. There was and always would be a groundlessness to the depths of my beginnings. That knowledge now existed in the place within me where all the secrets had once been stored, and despite the occasional free falls, it felt like a new form of strength. Which was a good thing, because in order to spend the next 6 weeks on the road, I had to split myself in two, take everything about the last year, and shelve it. I would be promoting my latest book, which concerned itself with marriage and memory. Innumerable times, I had listed among the strange twists and turns for which I was grateful the timing of my discovery. If I had found out the truth of my family history while I was writing Hourglass, it would have been a wrecking ball aimed straight at my delicate little book. The manuscript would have wound up in a drawer. Portland. The city stood out on my calendar amid all the other tour stops. It was part of a West Coast leg that included L.A., San Francisco, and Seattle. I had been in touch with the Walden family a month in advance, and the entire day in Portland was now planned. Lunch with Ben and Pilar before my reading at Powell's Books. Dinner afterward with Emily and her husband Scott. Even Emily's older kid, Nick, was planning to come to the reading. It was nearly the whole Walden Mishpacha. Michael was flying west to meet me in Portland. I told him he didn't have to, that I'd be okay. "I know you'll be okay," he'd said. "But you need a witness." To several degrees less than I'd felt the year before, when I went through the motions of my everyday life on that trip to San Francisco, making dinner reservations, calling Ubers, conferring on book jackets while attempting to metabolize the elephant, my time on tour once again had the strange quality of being on one side of a split screen while I held the rest at bay. It was hard work, this compartmentalization, this pushing away of what most consumed me. The sheer psychic effort of it was exhausting. I wondered how my parents had done it, jettisoned their knowledge of my origins. Had pediatrician appointments, how had my mother given my medical history without being gripped by persistent distress? How was it that they laughed about the Kodak holiday poster, holding up their daughter as an emblem of Christmas cheer? How deep did their denial have to go, and at what cost, in order to pulverize the truth until it no longer had shape or form? I tried not to concern myself with these questions as I zigzagged the country. Though in quiet moments, alone, on flights, or in solitary hotel rooms, it all reemerged the way suppressed thoughts tend to do. I had been high up in the air for weeks, nearly every day looking down at the flat plains, the mountain ranges, the world below, and it wasn't a far leap from there to think about geography and displacement. The country I'm from, the way I'd come to think of Ben. I had been living for a year in the last sea's landlessness. I often wondered what would have been the case if my parents had made a different choice, a more radical choice for the place and time in which they lived, and had told me the truth from a young age. What if I had been raised knowing that my father and I weren't related? What if I had always known that the reason I looked different and felt different was in fact because I was different? It would be easy to fantasize that this would have been better. But we can never know what lies at the end of the path not taken. Other difficulties, other heartaches, other complexities would certainly have emerged, but at least we would have been a family traversing them together. Michael was waiting for me when I got off the plane in Portland. We had just enough time to drop our bags off at the hotel and meet Ben and Pilar at a nearby restaurant. It was a gray, rainy day, traffic sluggish along Southwest Fifth Avenue. This time, I felt no nervousness, only pleasure in continuing the conversation that had begun haltingly a year before and had grown into something comfortable, no matter how unusual or at moments disconcerting. I still had questions for Ben, ones I wasn't sure I could ask. I wanted to know more about how many times he had donated. A dozen? 50? If I knew what his reference to a period of time meant, I would have some way of imagining how many half-siblings I might have in the world. I wasn't sure Ben wanted to think about that, and I was certain that Pilar did not. The four of us met at a steakhouse on the 30th floor of an office building, with floor-to-ceiling windows that overlooked the city and the distant, foggy outline of the Cascade Mountains. It was an airy, elegant place I sensed they'd arrived at with some care. This time, we all ordered a glass of wine, and the mood was more celebratory than cautious. Like children playing a game of tag, we knew which subjects were home base. We spoke about my tour, Michael's new film, and then about the endlessly absorbing topic of the current administration. They caught us up on their kids and grandkids and asked after Jacob, who was finishing up his junior year. The evening's plans, carefully calibrated, meant that Ben and Pilar were coming to Powell's to hear me read, and then they were taking their grandson Nick back home with them to spend the night so that Emily and Scott and Michael and I could go out to a late dinner. I kept thinking about what it would be like to be in front of a crowd, speaking about my new book to an audience that included my biological father and half-sister. My dad had died before I became a writer. He'd never read my work, nor seen me in the context of my professional world as an author. In the 30 years since his death, I had written 9 books. I had read from those books to hundreds of audiences all over the world. More times than I can count, with each new publication or upon receiving a particularly meaningful review, I would talk to him. "Dad, look, I wrote all these books for you." Now, my other father, my biological father, would be the one sitting in the audience watching me. Ben had written to me after our first meeting that although he could only claim a paternal genetic link, he was certainly proud of what I had accomplished, not just in my career, but also in establishing a wonderful, loving family. As grateful as I was for my relationship with Ben, my heart ached for my father. He had never experienced that parental pride, that kvelling, the Yiddish word he would have used. Ben was now a part of my adult life. He had met Jacob over FaceTime. He had traded stories with Michael. He would stand in line to have his book signed later that evening. If my parents had been able to flash forward for just half a second to a future in which, with both of them gone, I would be dining high above the city of Portland with the anonymous medical student they had pretended didn't exist, would they have proceeded? I would have loved to explore many of these intricacies with Ben, to ask the provocative, deep, hard questions about this strange terrain, and my sense was that he would have welcomed a complex conversation. But Pilar, despite her warmth, still seemed to be in some state of disturbance at the idea that she had never known Ben's history as a sperm donor, and the fact that the 3 adults they had raised together were not his only children. And I could hardly blame her. I couldn't imagine how I'd feel if a child of Michael's appeared one day, upending the size and shape of our family. As we lingered over coffee, Pilar asked a question I could tell had been haunting her. "So you've taken your name down?" At first I didn't know what she meant. "From the website? From Ancestry.com?" I was afraid to look at Michael. I wasn't sure how to answer. No, we hadn't taken my name down from Ancestry.com. In fact, we had spread my information as widely as possible among other sites, 23andMe, MyHeritage, GEDmatch, to increase the possibility that I would discover half-siblings, and they would discover me. I couldn't bring myself to tell Pilar that my DNA was readily discoverable, nor did I want to lie to her. As I was trying to formulate a response, Michael chimed in. "Adam Thomas's DNA is still up there, too," he said mildly. "But he told us it was private," Pilar said. Ben looked back and forth between us. I could tell that Michael and I were having the same thought. Let it go. Adam Thomas's DNA was every bit as discoverable as mine. If the Waldens had asked him to take it down, he hadn't complied, which meant that if biological offspring of Ben's found themselves on Ancestry.com, they would come up with the same mystery first cousin that I had, and, with a little ingenuity and journalistic chops, follow the trail of breadcrumbs all the way to Ben. Pilar seemed momentarily appeased by this false notion of privacy, both Adam Thomas's and my own. But then, a few minutes later, as Ben and Michael were engrossed in a different conversation, she leaned toward me and spoke with a hushed intensity. "Your daddy is a good daddy," she said. I thought I had misheard her. She rested a hand on my arm. "He's a very good daddy," she repeated. Our home is your home, she went on. You can stay with us anytime. I knew it had taken a lot for Pilar to let me in. But after the careful terminology, the genetic link, the biology, the delicate dance, the word daddy felt out of place. If any others come, she said, you won't tell them. You'll stay private. It was half question, half statement. And suddenly I understood. How old was too old for a surprise? A young medical student's casual decision now had the potential to shake up a retired doctor's life. Surely Ben, and Pilar too, had read stories about donor-conceived people who had discovered scores of half-siblings. Had they imagined a line of blonde, pink-cheeked offspring circling the block outside their home? Of course, there had to be a kernel of fear, even in their interaction with me. I laughed, as if there was something whimsical about the whole idea, and took a big sip of my abandoned glass of wine. In a way, Pilar's words provoked a train of thought I'd never before entertained, Ben as daddy. I pictured myself, sprawled on the floor in Ben and Pilar's comfortable home in their retirement community, playing backgammon. I imagined being in my pajamas and robe, drinking coffee, early in the morning, reading the paper with Ben. Perhaps we'd do the crossword together. And then, like a needle scratching across a vinyl record, the thoughts screeched to a stop. Ben was a lovely, caring man for whom I felt great fondness and gratitude. Knowing him was allowing me to put pieces of myself together in a way that would be of comfort to me for the rest of my life. He was my cloth, my country. But he was not my daddy. I felt for Pilar, I really did. She had raised a loving, tight-knit family. I resembled her husband more than any of their own children did. I'd seen a photo of Ben as a teenager, and Jacob looked a lot like him. What if, as I strongly suspected, there were others? More women or men in their early or mid-50s scattered around the country who were biological children of Ben's. Here was a massive ethical conundrum, one I would explore if the need ever presented itself. Part of me hoped it would never arise, at least not in their lifetimes. The question of what I owed them, my promise of privacy, and what I owed anyone who might someday contact me, was never far from my mind. If someone like me, stunned, traumatized, shocked, disbelieving, contacted me through one of the testing sites, asking how it was possible that we were listed as half-siblings, I couldn't turn that person away. I was that person. At the same time, I was acutely aware of Ben's kindness in being truthful with me from the beginning, as well as his courage and generosity in ultimately wishing to meet me. My words during our first lunch, you didn't have to do this. He could have ignored me or lied. He could have been rejecting, even cruel. Instead, Ben's inherent goodness also made me feel I came from that goodness. I felt enormously protective of both Ben and Pilar and would never want to hurt either of them. The exchange with Pilar happened in its own cocoon, so as the four of us left the table, there was no awkwardness. She hadn't exactly asked a question, nor had I attempted to answer. Ben had no idea the conversation had even taken place. I filed it away to be considered at another time. In the following months, as a steady stream of second and third cousins on the Walden side began to appear on my ancestry page, distant biological relatives with whom I saw no reason to connect, I'd think about the odds that a half-sibling would show up one day, and then another, and another. Who would these people be to me, and I to them? I had certainly benefited from being the first of Ben's offspring to stumble upon the truth. If I had not been the first, would he have ever responded to me? I was lucky. I understood that now. Recompense. I came from two men, my dad and Ben, who were honorable to the core. You can say this is beautiful, wonderful. What would I do with my good fortune? Chapter 50. Later that evening, I stand behind the lectern at Powell's Books, reading to a standing room only crowd. But I am constantly aware of the family taking up the entire fourth row. That line of warm, encouraging people is like a distant land seen from the churning sea. I take in only flashes, white hair, a blue shirt, a tall, angular man arriving late, my half-sister's wide, generous smile. But even as I bracket the air in front of me, moving my small hands in the same gesture as the man I come from, there is another man, the one who loved me into being, who I am looking for. There has rarely been an event of importance in my life when I have not searched for my father. Rarely a time during which I have not felt both his presence and his absence. I silently call to him, a Hebrew word, Hineni, here I am. Hineni, uttered only 8 times in the entire Torah, is less a statement of personal geography than an expression of presence and pure attentiveness. Abraham said it to God when he was asked to bind Isaac, and repeated it in response to his son. Jacob said it when he answered the call of an angel. Joseph said it to Jacob when he was sent to seek his brothers. Moses found his voice and said it to God at the burning bush. And I say it to my father again and again. Hineni, I am here. All of me. This is Danny Shapiro. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Inheritance, a memoir of genealogy, paternity, and love. This program was directed by Robert Kessler, executive producer Linda Korn. Text copyright 2019 by Danny Shapiro. Production copyright 2019, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.